Today we begin our new study in the book of Genesis. And I say Genesis, we're really going to concentrate on the middle section of the book. We're going to be looking primarily at the account of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so this morning, in our Bible classes, we're going to be moving very quickly from chapter 1 all the way up to chapter 11 as an introduction to our study. And I thought it would be only fitting for us to look at this beginning because of the controversy that continues to swirl around it, and I anticipate will until Christ comes back again. Some of this material I've presented before, but I think it's always appropriate to look again at this particular body of evidence. Let me say at the very outset, Christianity and science are in agreement. They are not opposed to one another. Whenever they are depicted as being at odds, you either have pseudo-science or counterfeit Christianity, or both. There are two opposing claims that today are taught and proposed. The first of these is that of creation, or as it's referred to by some, intelligent design or special creation. On the very first page of our Bible, the book of Genesis, chapter 1, verse 1, we read this assertion: "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." And this assertion is not made only here at the beginning of the Bible. It's seen throughout the pages all the way into the end. The passage that Holland read for us just moments ago out of Psalm 33, "By the word of the Lord were the heavens made, their starry host by the breath of His mouth." And that passage concludes with that affirmation: "He spoke and it came to be. He commanded, and it stood firm." David in the Psalms, on several occasions, talks about God's creative power in this universe. In Psalm 19, verse 1, David said, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows forth His handiwork." The Apostle Paul affirms it in the New Testament. In Colossians chapter 1, verse 16, Paul says, "For by Him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, both visible and invisible." And the Apostle John, in his gospel, begins with this affirmation: "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him, and without Him nothing was made that has been made." Now, Scripture speaks with one voice. God created the world with a word. He spoke, and it all came into existence. Evolution is the belief that matter has existed eternally, and that somewhere in the deep recesses of time, an unknown event or a series of events triggered a number of reactions which began the process which led to the evolution of non-living matter into living matter, which in turn has progressed through a series of millions, even billions, of upward advances until we have experienced intelligent life on this planet. Now, there are assumptions on both sides. There are assumptions that have to go with creation. There are assumptions that have to go with evolution. Creation assumes that God created matter from nothing. The Latin term is ex nihilo, and that we are here because of His intelligent design. Evolution assumes that matter has existed eternally and that we are here by accident. Now, this is a long and complicated discussion, and I'm not either equipped or nor do we have the time to go into all the intricacies of this. I'm not a scientist, but I can reason, and every one of you can reason. And so that's what I hope to do this morning. I simply want to appeal to reason as we ask, but really one question of the proponents of evolution. And that question is this: are the odds that evolution occurred within the realm of reason? There are two areas I want to look at that evolution uses. One of them is the belief in naturally occurring mutation. This is the belief that single-celled organisms somewhere along the path, through the process of mutation, move to ever more complex organisms. There are different theories of how this happened, but some say it happened over millions or billions of years, and that through mutation you see this upward progress from a single-celled organism to the human body. Others say, no, it happened rather quickly through quantum leaps, and in one fell swoop, major gains were made through this process of mutation. There's only one problem with that, and there may be others, but one obvious problem, and that is that naturally occurring mutation moves downward, not upward. I'm sure some of you have been in science labs and you've seen frogs with five legs. I know sometimes in nature you'll find freaks. I remember as a boy going into a museum and being amazed at a calf that had two heads. And we see mutations that occur in nature, but they are not helpful mutations, they are harmful mutations. Mutation moves downward, not upward in nature. Now, there are two examples that have been used by evolutionists to prove that there are cases where mutation moves in a positive direction. One is Thompson's seedless grape. A man named Thompson that lived in Massachusetts discovered among his grapes that some of them had very tiny seeds, and that there were even some mutations among his normal grapes where there were no seeds. And so he took the stock from these near seedless or seedless mutant varieties and began to experiment with them, and through his grafting was able to produce a species that had no seeds, thus the famous Thompson's seedless grape that we all enjoy to this very day. Now, that's a good mutation, it's been said. Well, it is for us, but it's not very good for the grape. Were it not for the process of grafting, it would become extinct because it can no longer reproduce itself. Another cited example of a positive mutation is a variety of sheep. A mutant sheep was born that had extremely short legs. Darwin observed this particular mutation, an Ancom sheep it was called. And through breeding of this mutant sheep with other varieties, they were able to produce a strain of short-legged sheep. Now, again, this was a great benefit because this sheep couldn't jump fences, and shepherds were able to contain their sheep much more easily. But again, who's it good for? Well, it's good for the shepherd, but you let a wolf get in among the sheep, and that little sheep can't run very fast. And so it's not good for the species. One of those who writes about this particular variety of sheep says this mutation would bring about extinction in a natural environment. And so again, mutation in nature, freaks of nature, are not positive things, they are negative things. Evolution requires a continual chain of positive mutation in order to move from a single-celled organism to a living human being, and we simply do not find that in our observation of nature. Now, I want to look at another area here that I personally find very convincing, and that's the area of probability. Probability is defined as a measure of the likeliness that an event will occur. When I was in college, I was a business major. My undergraduate studies were in business. It wasn't until grad school that I studied theology. But in my business studies, one of the courses that I took was probability and statistics, and I loved that class. We did all kinds of experiments, beginning with the flipping of a coin to see that the probability is 50-50, and when you flip it enough times, it'll always measure 50-50. Half the time it'll be heads, half the time it'll be tails. Odds can be calculated for any event. Probability, the study of probability, is a widely used science. It's used in physics, it's used in finances, in the insurance industry especially, to establish actuary tables. It's used in computer science. It's used in artificial intelligence. It's used in gambling. And the usefulness of probability goes on and on. Astronomers can calculate the likelihood of a meteor hitting New York City. And they can give you the odds. Having studied the number of meteors that typically come by the Earth in any given number of years, and they can tell you what the odds are for an unlikely event like that. Meteorologists can give us the likelihood that we would have a 3-foot snowfall in Springfield, Missouri on December the 25th. They can go back and look through the records. They can predict with a fair degree of accuracy what the probability of a number of events are. Now, when the odds of anything happening become incredibly high, there is a point that scientists will say that has moved into the realm of impossibility. What are the odds? Anyone here willing to make a wager? What are the odds that I will come out as the starring quarterback for the Rams this season? Well, it's possible. I could hit the gym. I mean, you know, but we recognize the odds of that happening are so far beyond calculation that we would say that falls into the realm of impossibility. What are the odds that Dwight Samuel would drive a dirty car? Now, don't you tell him I said that. He's gone today, and I thought I'd use him as an example. There are certain odds that are so high that we place them in the realm of the impossible. Now, impossibility, or the realm of the impossible, is defined as the stage at which any probability crosses the point of 1 in 10 to the 50th. Once that mathematical calculation is reached, all scientists agree that's where it goes from extremely unlikely to impossible. It will never happen. It can never happen. As we begin to calculate the odds for life occurring on our planet by accident, all kinds of things must be factored in. There are all kinds of components necessary for life to occur. The electrical forces must be within a relatively narrow range on the planet to permit the formation of the necessary elements that even sustain life. So you've got to have that in place. The Earth must be tilted at exactly the right degree, at 23 degrees, in fact, on its axis. Otherwise, water vapors would condense at the poles and create huge mountains of ice, rendering life on the planet impossible. If the Earth was not rotating at its current speed, the temperatures on the surface of the Earth could no longer support life. If the moon were only 1/5 its present distance from the earth, huge tides would sweep over the tallest mountains on earth. For life to have begun by accident, the right odds in these and thousands of other areas would have to have existed in the exact proportions, in the right ways, in the correct order, in order to produce living organisms. And if by chance a single-celled organism did, somewhere on the surface of this planet, spring into existence, it would have to be in close geographical proximity to another living organism so that they could get together and so that they could begin to produce life in some future form. Now, all this would have to happen in spite of the fact that it's never been observed to have happened. And oddly enough, scientists are puzzled by the fact that it's not continuing to happen, even in our day. If it happened once, why isn't it continuing to happen today? The probability, if you factor these odds together, and this varies from scientist to scientist, but if you do a search on your computer or if you look in science textbooks, it'll come somewhere in this range. The probability of producing a human cell by chance is 1 in 10 to the 119th thousandth. 119,000. Now, you remember what the definition of an impossibility is? 1 in 10 to the 50th. Once it goes beyond that, 1 in 10 to the 51st, it's in the range of impossibility. This is 1 in 10 to the 119,000th. Way beyond the realm of impossibility. Did you know that there are better odds for believing that this structure in which we're housed this morning was created by accident? Could it have been created by accident with the right elements in the right order and storms and the composition? Could these things all have fallen into place? Well, that would probably range above that definition of impossibility. And yet, the odds of this building having been formed by accident are much greater than the human body and all of its complexity having happened through a series or a chain of accidents. Now the question is, why are some scientists prepared to accept such incredible odds? And any scientist that you'll talk to will tell you, yes, there are incredible odds at stake here. And I am convinced through what I've read that it's simply a matter of prejudice. D.M.S. Watson, the eminent English scientist, writes, "Evolution is accepted not because it has been observed to occur or can be proved by logically coherent evidence to be true, but because the only alternative, special creation, that which Genesis speaks of, is clearly incredible." If these scientists are backed into the corner and if they have to choose this account or these incredible odds, they'll go with the incredible odds. The British evolutionist Sir Arthur Keith has written, "Evolution is unproved and unprovable. We believe it because the only alternative is special creation, which is unthinkable, that a God could speak the world into existence." I want to close this morning by sharing with you my concern about the theory of evolution as it is currently taught, as if it were fact. It's still called the theory. We need to remember that, the theory of evolution. It has taken God from His rightful place as the creator of the universe and has been the impetus for all sorts of godless doctrines and beliefs? Did you know that Hitler accepted the evolutionary teachings of Nietzsche? He's the one who coined the phrase survival of the fittest. Hitler bought into that, and he put it into a political philosophy. He decided to help the belief of survival of the fittest along through his political agenda by stamping out all the inferior species and creating a super race, and thus we had the birth of Nazism. Mussolini in Italy frequently quoted Darwin. He said the idea of peace was repugnant to the idea of the survival of the fittest and the progress of the race. He said, and I quote, "War is essential for the survival of the fittest." Thus was born fascism. Karl Marx, in his writing Das Kapital, asked Charles Darwin to write his preface, and he did, because he felt that Darwin had provided a scientific foundation for communism. You see, all kinds of beliefs and agendas have spun off of this belief in the survival of the fittest, and that we are a mere accident, that God is not involved in the equation. In Charles Darwin's book, Origin of the Species, he writes this preface. Now, I don't believe that Charles Darwin himself was a racist, but this teaching has provided all sorts of foundations for racism in our world. If you'll read the print there closely, and you may not be able to see it, it says, "Their preservation of favored races in the struggle for life." You see, in the final analysis, either way you go, creation or evolution, it's a matter of faith. We've got to admit that as Christians too. It's a matter of faith. We cannot prove scientifically that God created the world in the book of Genesis. In fact, Genesis doesn't even address many of the questions we put to it. Evolution is unprovable scientifically. It is in the realm of impossibility, according to the rules of statistics and probability. If you accept evolution, you accept it by faith. But creation is also not provable scientifically. Yet for me, it is much easier to believe that everything that I see exists and was created by a superior intelligence. That superior intelligence, the book of Genesis reveals to us as God, the Creator. But in the end, it's a matter of faith. And that's why we read those words of the Hebrew writer. By faith, he says, we understand that the worlds were prepared by the Word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of the things which are visible. I'd love to continue this conversation with any of you. But as we close this morning, if we can assist anyone who's here today, we'll gladly do that while we stand and while we sing.